Welcome to another edition of Book Talk. I'm Blake McVeigh, and I'm happy to welcome Rob Sangster to the program today. Mr. Sangster's latest installment of his Jack Strider thriller series, a volume entitled No Return, has recently been published by Bellbridge Books. As the novel opens, the story begins to build around the race to control a large cache of rare earth elements, which are key to the manufacture of computers, smartphones, and many other tools vital to our current digital landscape. Is there a real-life drama in particular with rare earth elements that informs this story?
Yes, of course. Each of my novels takes life based on something that I've read that has captured my attention that I can't let go. And typically I'll begin to research it, not so much thinking of a novel, but as I do, as with rare earth elements, I become absolutely fascinated. That's the point at which I want to share it. And the vehicle being fiction, then I have to think who ought to be on this stage. Partly because of some of my background, in this case, the protagonist was the CEO of the largest investment banking firm in the world, which some people might think resembles Goldman Sachs.
Right.
Goldman Sachs and its CEO. And then I thought, how would Goldman Sachs interact with rare earth elements? Mm-hmm. When you know that 95% of all rare earth elements on this planet are produced in China, then you see that that's a growing problem. As China becomes more and more aggressive in the production, the manufacturing of products, it's keeping more of them for itself. And as you said in your introduction, they are essential to smartphones, to jet aircraft, to computers, to almost right across the technology spectrum. So what could he do? Well, what he did was set out to control all the rest of the rare earth elements not inside China. And he did very well at that until that wasn't satisfactory. As befits the CEO of an investment banking firm,
right,
there is no enough. So he found a way to begin to bet on the forward price of rare earth elements. When he couldn't find enough people to bet against him because everyone agreed that they would get more scarce and the prices would go up, he found a place to bet, in Singapore in this case, on the price in the future and became more and more aggressive in acquiring them. That's what led him to an ultimate collision with Jack Strider.
So tell us a little bit about this opening scene in Inner Mongolia.
I think if you went to any competent writing instructor, they would tell you not to do what I did in that opening scene. I opened with a location which the reader will never see again. I opened with two or three characters whose names are new to them, and although they will see them again, they're a bit difficult to pronounce, and the place names are difficult. And the description that I gave of it is a place to which you would never want to go. I mean, it's the worst of the industrial wastelands of that part of China in Inner Mongolia. It's real. It exists pretty much the way I described it. Honestly, I wanted to see if I could do that. And then make the transition back to the real world. And it's a stark transition straight into Wall Street and international banking. I bring back the Chinese characters in the middle of the book and, of course, right at the very end. Mm-hmm. I mean them to be menacing. I'm determined not to make them caricatures. It's an economic equation, and I'm convinced that it will occur. But I really enjoyed that. I really enjoyed the challenge.
I feel like it was an effective opening to the book because my mind went back there several times. Not only as I was reading the book at several points did I think back at this kind of squalid scene at the beginning of the book, but also there would be times when I was far away from the book and I was just going about my daily life, and for whatever reason, that scene would just kind of pop in my head and I would ponder the whole, you know,
what
the mining of rare earth elements.
Yeah.
There was something really effective about that first chapter in the setting. It worked for me.
I'm delighted. I could not have asked for more because I wanted to plant that and then have people wonder, you know, some number of readers who will read it, move on, and never think of it again, mm-hmm, until it comes up again in the middle. Others, in your case, you're the ideal. You're wondering why it was there and what it meant and where all that will reappear.
it made perfect sense to me that even though there was that dramatic shift in scenery and character and everything else, it seemed like a natural place to start.
It also permitted me to introduce an antagonist without labeling it or them, the Chinese government, as such. But it was like Jaws. I mean, when you think of Jaws, you're going to hear that sound. It's going to be this unseen menace. And the book ends with that unseen menace rising and becoming much more of a threat. So that part, that was a challenge. That's why it's fun to, so much fun to write.
I'm thinking in particular of a Chinese cell phone manufacturer that has recently been in the news and caused some controversy. I guess that really occurred too late to have any sort of consideration for this particular novel.
Yeah. My novels don't move that swiftly.
A bit prophetic, perhaps?
Yes, very much. And there is no question about it. The attitude in China has changed. For decades, it was willing simply to be the supplier of raw materials. Mm-hmm. Prices for rare earth elements were comparatively low. That's what's changed. And as with each of my novels, I'm looking toward the future. And that means that you can expect to see this become a major issue, I would say, within a year.
That you know of, is there a real-life version of this mysterious undersea mine that Jack Strider comes to own?
Absolutely.
Okay.
When you read these books of mine, you can count on that they will be fact-based. Japan has now discovered rare earth elements on the seabed. The seabed is the critical change.
Right.
We've been finding rare earth elements just across the landscape in very limited quantities. But from a scientific standpoint, it's much more likely that they will be plentiful on the seabed. The Chinese found a very small deposit. They think it's small. Don't know yet.
Right.
But it definitely proves the science. The deposit that Jack Strider has control of at the moment is much, much larger. Certainly large enough to make a difference in who controls the world.
Well, and with the soon creation of the Space Force, maybe we'll find rare earth elements in space somewhere. And that could be your next novel.
Yeah.
Deep Time was the previous novel, the second Strider novel. How much time occurs between the two? What's the story there?
There's about a two-year gap. And that enables Jack Strider to finish his adventures in Deep Time, establish his law firm on Pier 9 in San Francisco on the waterfront, and begin to get into practice and representing people in the public interest.
Would the novels, there's three, of course, now, would they stand well on their own, or would a reader, would a prospective reader be better off starting from one and going through to three and possibly beyond?
Very good question. They're absolutely standalone. And if I were advising someone, I'd start with the third one because I'm becoming a better writer, to be candid with you. No, they're standalone, but there are always bits of backstory. So you'll learn a bit about where Jack and Deborah and Gaino Lemoyne and other continuing characters have been in the past. That's a tricky balance. You don't want to bore people with a lot of stuff that they don't want to know about, they don't need to know about, nor do you want to leave them floating in the current novel. But they're definitely standalone novels.
Are you inspired at all by a particular series from the past, something that you read as you were growing up or something along those lines?
I don't think so. I'm very fond of Mark Graney's writing. I like Michael Crichton. I like writing that pushes the boundaries, makes you think about stuff. I would like people to get partway through this novel and challenge me, be doubtful that what I'm putting out as fact could really be true.
Right.
I want that to happen. And then when they reach the end, I want them to be convinced, absolutely convinced that it is true, and that they can anticipate all my issues becoming part of their futures.
So speaking of challenging writing, you kind of veered into some mild political, I don't know if commentary would be the right word or not. How intentional was that?
Intentional is not the right word. Compulsive is the word. Fortunately, I have several friends who are quite good editors.
Uh-huh.
And if you think you saw some political polemic in there now, you should have seen the early drafts. I try not to do that, but one of the things that I get to do as the writer is to stake out some territory.
Right.
So I'm conscious of not wanting to be offensive to any readers.
Yes.
But by the same token, as in the case of this one, Goldman Sachs or mm-hmm. Sterling Hanover, as it is in my book,
right.
You know, they're political entities. They have huge political impact in our country. So, yes, it's there.
Do you ever have any ambition of writing something that's more overtly political?
I probably will not, because that's a very crowded field. I deceive myself from time to time thinking I do, but I don't know that I have enough novel ideas mm-hmm. in the political field to make that worthwhile. But I think my strength is elsewhere, as shown in these books. Each one of them has a particular and hopefully unique centerpiece, as the first two did. It's like gravity or a magnet, something that captured me in the beginning, and I began to weave a book around it.
No Return ends on somewhat of a cliffhanger. So how far does this series go? Are you of the mind that you'll just keep writing till it runs out of energy? What are your plans there?
I'm very comfortable with the three major characters. And I'm most happy about the fact that each one of them has changed significantly, particularly the protagonist. If the characters are static, it's a cartoon.
Yeah.
It's really not worth reading a second novel. I paid much more attention to that in this novel, of Jack's feelings, his maturation along the way, his doubts, a little more of his backstory. Not enough to be tedious, I hope, but but to show that he's a real person, that he's not a one-dimensional good guy. And by the same token, my antagonists, I hope, in this case, Slade, he too has some, at least superficially, good characteristics. For example, he, in real life and perhaps otherwise, and in my novel, he could also be the kind of guy who during the day did a whole bunch of terrible things and then went to a reception at a gallery he had donated to the Museum of Art. I do intend to continue, and that we'll have the same three central characters, but it will be a radically different plot. Okay. There won't be any repetition.
It's the Jack Strider series. Would you ever give any thought to focusing on one of the other two main characters, such as like a book particularly about Deborah, for example?
Oh, I absolutely would. Taking it in reverse order, Gaynor LeMoyne somehow, he's almost out of my control. Writing him is so natural, and the feedback I get about him is consistent. Everybody loves this guy. I'm not sure that he has the gravitas to be the center of a novel. Deborah, in each case, I have tried to present her as a central character. Mm-hmm. There is a lot of conflict in my novels. There's some fights in the novels. There is no gratuitous violence, or for that matter, gratuitous foul language, simply because I don't think either one is appropriate. Deborah is a little bit handicapped in some of the larger conflict scenes. However, in Deep Time, I portray her in a physical sense as being a highly skilled warrior, and intellectually, she's every bit Jack Strider's mm-hmm. equal, emotionally his superior by far. So, yes, she could be at least a central character in the future. In Deep Time, she has a completely separate plot line in which she has filed a lawsuit against what I'm calling Armstrong Air Force Base in Northern California, which is seriously polluting its environment, and people are dying because of it.
You mentioned that in this novel, at least briefly.
Yeah, I call it Armstrong Air Force Base. It's actually Travis Air Force Base, based on real facts. That is Deborah's charge, and she is carrying that case all by herself quite successfully.
You've worked as an attorney for several years and many other posts across the nation, traveled to over 100 countries. You appear to be just a very natural individual to write such a series as this. How did this all begin for you?
It began sitting against a defunct termite mound in Botswana. Just such a splendid experience where I was in the Okavango Delta. And I thought, you know, everybody ought to have this experience. Not that, nothing all that much about the termite mound, but
right.
just being in that place and so remote, out in the total wilderness. So I decided to write a book that would empower people to do that, seduce them mm-hmm. to travel to faraway places. and empower them, making it a how-to book, not a guidebook about various places, but taking everybody's hesitation about travel seriously, treating them as valid and saying, but here's how you can handle that, whether it's health or safety or money, all the things that do keep people. So I wrote that book, and it was called Traveler's Toolkit, How to Travel Absolutely Anywhere. And it was very successful. In fact, it was picked up as a Book of the Month Club by some miracle.
Nice.
And I really enjoyed that. It had legs. It stayed around for three different versions. So that was great. Then that fateful point at which hubris said to me, well, why don't you write a novel? I mean, how big a transition could that be?
Right.
And the answer is they have nothing to do with each other, fiction and nonfiction. I think the only thing that I can be sure that transferred is spelling. Spelling you use in both places is fairly consistent. Otherwise, I went back to zero.
Wow.
I had to start learning how to write fiction. And I'm enough of a student that I really love that. That's why I say these books have gotten better as I continue. The settings are fine, the characters fine, all that, but the actual skill of fiction writing takes some time to mature.
So did the nature of your note-taking, once you decided to write fiction, did the nature of your note-taking change at all? Was it more? Was it less?
It couldn't be more. As I was traveling all those countries, I always kept a journal, and I worked in that journal every night. I could not have written those various books without them because they recalled. And fortunately, they were the kinds of journals that didn't simply record what was on the wall of the museum.
Right.
They helped me remember the people in the museum and the people on the street and so on. I still do that now. The addition now is a camera. So I probably have 30 or 40,000 images from around the world. Very helpful in writing fiction. The travels have been really important to the settings of these novels. This one, as you know, it opens in Inner Mongolia, for God's sake. I mean, that's...
And you don't paint a particularly pretty picture of the scene, at least at that point in time, at that particular spot.
Yes. And that, of course, is intentional, and it's, and it is also realistic. Mm. Not someplace that you'd go on vacation. But the settings, to me, are really important. I think every author brings different things to the table. At some of them, I'm better than at others. No Return, it's like one of those cooking shows where they give you four or five or six completely incompatible pieces.
Right.
Say, now make something wonderful. Well, in this case, I have Inner Mongolia. I have the San Francisco waterfront. I have the River of No Return in Idaho. I've got Wall Street. And you think, okay, see what you can do with those.
So let's talk for just a little bit about Jack Strider himself. He's mainly an attorney, the side gig as an action hero. How much have you drawn from your own experience as an attorney? Really, the question is, are you Jack Strider?
Yeah, right. That's an inevitable question, and of course. I am Jack Strider in one respect, and that is I feel very strongly that lawyers ought to contribute to the public interest. And one reason I left the practice of law, other than the fact that I was offered the ideal job, best job in the world in Washington, was because I didn't like the balance. I was doing mostly corporate securities law, some other kinds, but I wasn't contributing much, in my opinion, to my community. And I was not encouraged to do that either. I was encouraged to bill hours. One characteristic of Jack Strider is that he is always doing something in the public interest. So to that extent, okay, we're similar. A lot of the things that he does are things that I do. He does all of them better than I do. But whether it's rock climbing or sailing, as I am, running down a whitewater river, as in No Return. I love doing that. I've been down that river. So, and of course, this is why I would choose it.
Yeah, and you returned.
You know, the reason they call it that is that the Aboriginal people, the original people who were there, said it was not possible to return upriver because the current was so strong and the rapids were so fierce that you couldn't go back upriver. They also called it the River of No Return because so many people were killed on it.
Mm-hmm.
So, yes, I did come out the other end.
So is there anything more you can reveal about the background of Jack Strider? We know he's the attorney and the sailor and very competent in a lot of different ways, but what was his beginning? Is that something that is addressed in the first novel?
It is. As a matter of fact, it was quite a rocky start. He was a professor at Stanford Law School. He was effectively disinvited from the faculty because his father, the judge in San Francisco, turned out to be quite a horrible person and was ultimately would have been sent to jail but for having committed suicide instead, left quite a stain on Jack. So he had to reboot himself in the private sector in a big law firm. That's what started him on the current trajectory. Deborah Vandenberg was a student of his at the law school. He was quite enamored, but under the rules of the game, could not make any kind of an approach to her. Later, it turned out she was a rising star in this large San Francisco law firm that he joined. But while she was the rising star, he was actually a bit of a tarnished star. So they ultimately developed a relationship. When he was assigned in that novel to serve a client in Juarez, Mexico, he got in deep trouble. And it turned out that the person he called on was somebody he'd met in a local bar, Gaino Lemoine, who became a sort of a swashbuckling character, a pilot who generally was flying drugs around Mexico, that sort of thing. And they became quite fast friends. So in No Return, the current book, when Jack gets in really deep trouble up in the mountains, he's fleeing the bad guys, he calls Gaino to fly in and help them, and Gaino stays with him for the rest of the trip.
You mentioned in your bio that you divide most of your time between here in Memphis and home in Nova Scotia, Canada, which is where you write. Any particular reason why you spend most of your writing time there as opposed to anywhere else?
Yes, far fewer distractions. I'm involved in things here in Memphis having to do with all sorts of civic issues. And then just the pace of life is different here. When I'm there, our home is right on the ocean. And there's another reason, and that is out of good fortune, we wound up in the midst of a very artistic community, many of whom are writers. So that's particularly congenial. My wife is a superb and award-winning writer, and it's just a place where we can go and the pressure drops, the tension level coming from the world reduces, and it's something I would recommend for any writer.
So what is it like to live in a two-writer home?
I'd say it works very much to my benefit. I consider her a better writer than I, more of a scholar of writing than I am. A little bit humbling, but there it is. I wouldn't consider submitting a piece for publication without running it past her. She feels, I think, with far less reason, the same way about me. So we do interact. There's no jealousy, no competition. We do interact quite a bit.
Is there any part of the Jack Strader, Deborah Vandenberg relationship that reflects your own relationship?
Well, the name Deborah Vandenberg comes from my past. So it wouldn't be this relationship. But no, I would say not. I didn't intentionally pattern it.
The previous work, Deep Time, was the winner of an award, the Epic Award. Unless I'm mistaken, that has to do with ebook.
Correct.
Is there an ebook version of No Return?
Oh, sure. Interesting story about the Epic. I received a notice from them about a year ago that my book was a finalist as the best suspense thriller for the year. And I was thrilled. I thought that was really nice. You know, you get these little pats on the back, most of which do not come from your editor. But then I looked up the other finalists, and I was so clearly inferior to them in terms of the volume and the name recognition, that sort of thing, that instead of going to the award conference, I went out to California to visit my son. And that's when we got a call, very snippy call, saying, "You won. Yours is the best of the whatever. And by the way, it's more customary for the nominees to show up at our conference."
Oh, no.
Yeah, they were a little miffed. So that was a nice experience.
Again, Rob Sangster is the author of No Return, the latest in his Jack Strider series, published by Bellbridge Books. I'm Blake McVeigh, and this has been Book Talk.
Thank you for joining us today. Book Talk is produced in the studios of FM 89.3 WYPL Memphis, a service of the Memphis Public Library, a division of the City of Memphis. Book Talk is copyrighted by the Memphis Public Library, all rights reserved.